Welcome to episode 72 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I'm Greg Weeks, political scientist at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. And I am talking to Christine Wade. She's professor of political science, international studies at Washington College. She studies Central America. It's the author of Captured Peace, Elites, and Peace Building in El Salvador. And also now out is the seventh edition of her co-authored Understanding Central America, Global Forces and Political Change. Christine, thanks for coming back.
Thanks so much, Greg. Thanks for having me on this morning.
I think this is the third time.
I'm very popular here at this podcast.
I might be a wreck. Well, because, see, we probably talk about this, is that these bad things happen in Central America. I'm like, oh, I wonder what Christine thinks about these things. So.
Yeah, right. Well, I think we talked last time. Nobody ever calls me when anything good is happening.
Yeah, I'm working on that. So a couple podcasts ago, I was more or less ranting about civil-military relations, and obviously El Salvador came up in that rant. And so that's, at least initially here, that's what we'll talk about. Can you just give just a brief recap on what Nayib Bukele's been doing, but also how unusual it is for post-war El Salvador?
Sure. So as you probably know, a couple of weeks ago, President Bukele became frustrated, apparently by the pace of negotiations over the legislature's approval of a foreign loan bill, right, by the BCIE that would fund part of his security plan. And in an apparent show of strength, tried to use his, I would say, popularity to outmaneuver the legislature, perhaps cow them into voting on the loan, gathered his supporters in front of the legislative assembly, and had the military occupy the Salon Azul, which is the meeting space for the legislatures. prior to that, he had attempted to force the deputies of the legislative assemblies into what the Constitution refers to as an extraordinary session on a Sunday afternoon so that they would have to vote on that loan. And knowing that that wasn't going to happen, he created something of a bit of a spectacle, right? Predominantly for his supporters, to talk about possibilities for insurrection, and then ultimately to make him his own way into the legislative assembly for his performance, we'll say.
And so, how unusual is that show of force for El Salvador?
In the post-war era, obviously, pretty unusual, right? I mean, I can't think of a time that I've ever seen the military in the legislature. And that might even include wartime in El Salvador. So pretty unusual step to take. We've seen in the past, a couple of attempts of politicians to drag members of the military into political debate. Usually the military has, brushed this off. This side story to this was frankly that the military allowed itself to be used as a prop, in Bukele's, Sunday spectacle. So there are layers to this, I think, beyond just Bukele's use of the military, but really the willingness of the military to be used in this way.
And, I was sort of thinking, you mentioned how he had gathered his supporters, and part of that was he's always doing selfies, right? There's like this sort of vibe to it. And I keep wondering whether I respond to that just because I'm now quite a bit older than Bukele. And I'm like, is the use of the military just part of a show? I mean, do you think he sees this as leverage, but how serious is it? You know what I mean?
Yeah, my read on it is that it was a show, that it was designed to be a spectacle, that it was designed to not only boost supporters who frankly were pretty keen on his use of the military in that way, but also to show that he has the upper hand in terms of popularity in the country. Whether he has done this unwittingly or not remains to be seen. The big question is really, whether, Bukele can get the genie back in the bottle. It's not really clear that he appreciates the potential forces he may have unleashed by doing this. You know, he thinks that this is, in other words, I think he thinks this was a simple afternoon matter. And what are people getting so outraged about with the military and the Salon when we've had, you know, tens of thousands of Salvadorans killed in gang violence after the war, and we've got these corrupt politicians? Why is everybody obsessed? In fact, he says this in his El País editorial. Why is everybody so obsessed or fixated with this, you know, one picture in the Salon Azul?
Okay. And thinking more broadly, there was, I think it was wasn't it the Guatemalan president who tweeted at least somewhat approvingly? I mean, do you get any sense that this could be contagious, or is this going to remain in El Salvador?
Well, I mean, I think we've seen it elsewhere before. I mean, we certainly saw it last August when Jimmy Morales announced that he wasn't going to renew CSIG. And he does so at a press conference where he is flanked by like two dozen military officers, high ranking, special forces, tanks rolling through the streets, all to announce that he was not going to renew CSIG. So I think we've seen this before, right? The big difference in the case of Jimmy Morales is he was taking away something that was actually very politically popular, right?
Yeah.
That he might have thought, you know, people might have come out into the streets for. Nayib Bukele did it predominantly for theatrics, for a vote that was going to happen inevitably anyway.
Right.
But, you know, we've seen really, truly since the mid-1990s in Central America, in different countries in different ways, sort of the, you know, mission creep of the military, first in terms of security, providing security, right, the militarization of police forces. And now we're seeing them used by some presidents at the, you know, really at the forefront of politics.
Yeah, and I think the point that you made just a couple minutes ago about the genie is a good one, even comparatively, because Bukele might see it as a show and other presidents might see it as a show, but we don't know if the military does.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Salvadoran military, to its credit, has been one of the more institutionalized armed forces in the region since demilitarization and the peace accords, right? If you compare it to Guatemala, where we know that clandestine, you know, organizations have continued to operate and have lots of tentacles into power. But what we don't know is, you know, whether there's a level of nostalgia for the good old days for the military in El Salvador, which, you know, had power either real or de facto for decades.
Yeah.
Right. And whether or not there are some people that miss the good old days. I mean, we don't know that, you know, what the level of satisfaction with the current state of the military is in the country.
Right. And that's often something that you don't know until suddenly something happens.
Yeah. Surprise. Right. I mean,
yeah.
You don't. We did see, I think he was a colonel or a lieutenant colonel in the Salvadoran military, resigned his title over everything and posted it on Twitter. And it was really quite a remarkable statement about the way that the armed forces had, as he viewed, intervened in politics.
Yeah.
I've sort of characterized them as willing pawns, you know, and I don't, you know, like you said, we often don't have good assessments of the internal machinations of the military until something actually happens.
Yeah. Now, back to the reasons this happened in the first place. How do Bukele's anti-crime policy proposals differ, if at all, from his predecessors? Is he trying to do anything new?
Well, this is the fun part. We don't know.
Okay.
Because, well, there's no policy. I mean, no one I know has seen a policy.
Really?
It has a name. Well, not a written policy. It has a name. It's planned territorial control. It seems to consist of, you know, increasing numbers of police, which is really just building upon what we have seen in the past, right? Monodura policies. They don't seem to differentiate. When he was mayor and when he was running for president, he did talk a lot about prevention. If there are big preventative programs going on, I'm not entirely sure that we know what those are. But for, I think, a lot of analysts, this plan territorial control, which is what the plan is called, is something of a mystery.
Okay, but aren't homicide rates down? Wasn't there something like that that was down that he was trying to take credit for?
Yeah, homicide rates are down actually pretty dramatically in El Salvador over the past 2 years. But certainly, within the last, 6 months of 2019, which is when he was president, right? They were already on the decline the first half of the
Okay.
year. And they were in decline in years prior years. So 2018, right, was also a pretty remarkable decline from the year prior to that. We don't know why the homicide rates are declining. And I've talked to a number of analysts in El Salvador. Nobody can really tell you why the homicide rates are declining. There's a lot of speculation about it. And none of it really includes the fact that this planned territorial control is behind the drop in homicides,
Okay, so it
right?
predates him, and there's always
Yeah.
rumors about collusion with organized crime, right?
Sure. So, I mean, and it could be a combination of things. It could be that perhaps whatever this plan is has become more effective over time. But we suspect that it's probably operating in combination with a couple of different things. That could be collusion, right? Some sort of deal that's been struck with gangs. The other idea, of course, is that gangs are internally suppressing, right, violence. In other words, that gangs are still very much in control of levels of violence and that they have suppressed it in reaction to what were stepped up policies by the prior administration. Which were, really brutal for gangs, right? And spread them outside of city centers and such. And so there's was one question of, have gangs, suppressed their activities to take the heat off of them, basically. The other factor is the question of whether or not the homicide rate is being displaced by disappearances, right? Because El Salvador has, there are still a lot of disappearances in El Salvador. And disappearances are not calculated into the homicide rate. And there are more disappearances in 2019 and in 2018 than there were homicides.
Wow.
So it may, yeah, so it may be that we find that they find victims later, but they are not calculated into the homicide rate.
Oh, okay. So just somehow they're more hidden.
Right. And so it could be sometimes you find, mass graves or you find
Right.
victims' bodies or maybe you don't find them at all. But we know that reports of disappearances have been fairly consistent. They may be lower from year to year, but they've consistently been higher the last 2 years than the reported homicide rate. So the question is what do we do with disappearances? It's clear that El Salvador isn't necessarily less violent. Right, if we have, all of these disappearances, but are they deaths? Are they people who've simply migrated? That seems unlikely. What's happening to these people and where are these bodies at? Because
Right.
without a body, we don't have a homicide.
Right. Now, thinking more along the lines of the politics of it, the institutions, some of the impetus for all of this was that the traditional parties were the ones that didn't want to go along with
Yeah.
what Bukele wanted. So, is the party system in El Salvador dying?
Well, it's premature, I think, to say that it's
I
dying, but
asked it as a
certainly
question.
no, I think certainly old parties are struggling. Really not only under the weight of history, but under the weight of recent corruption, right? The FMLN in particular has been hit very, very hard at the polls the last presidential and legislative elections. Lots of dissatisfaction with the FMLN. And a lot of those people defected and voted for Bukele. The FMLN had failed to control violence. It had failed to can do anything meaningful on, past legacies of impunity. The conditions of the country had not improved. People perceived that the FMLN's ideology was a barrier to its relationship with the United States, which was causing economic problems. And in many ways, the FMLN never found its space as a post-revolutionary leftist party. What does that mean, and how does that function within the reality of global capitalism? Because as much as the left may not like it, this is the reality in which it operates, right? So what does that mean for the FMLN, in the 2000s? And And certainly its capacity as a political party has been greatly eroded. ARENA faces some similar erosion. Certainly a number of people who had supported ARENA went out to vote for Bukele last February. But ARENA has always been an American-style political party. I mean, it's an engine. It functions just like the DNC or the RNC in terms of its organizational capability and its financial capability, too, which significantly outmatches that of the FMLN. So I think it's been able to weather the storm a little bit better than the FMLN has. And so the question for both parties is, you know, how they reinvigorate themselves. How do they break free of, you know, wartime legacies where you're nominating guerrillas or people who were part of the oligarchy as presidential candidates or deputies? I mean, how do they move beyond that and find something new for themselves, I think is a challenge for them.
Is Bukele building anything sustainable? Is it something that could include other people, or is it really just him?
Honestly, it's really hard to say, right? I mean, his party, which will conceivably be registered to participate in next February's legislative elections, Nuevas Ideas, I don't have a great sense of how it's going to be formulated, how it's going to operate, how primaries are going to work, how candidate selection is going to work. I think there are a lot of logistical questions about how that party will function that we just don't know. I think it's pretty easy to look at Bukele and see something of a cult of personality.
Sure.
Because he lends himself very well to that. I mean, he lends himself very well to appearing as his own brand, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, in terms of building a long-term political movement, there's a problem with that.
Right.
You know, you can't have a party about one person. So the success of his political machine ultimately will be about his ability to decentralize power, to grow leadership within the party that is beyond him. And
yeah.
He has a very healthy ego, I think. So, you know, whether that's of interest to him is not clear.
Yeah, and there's plenty of examples in Latin America where charismatic leaders were completely unable to do that.
Yes.
Unwilling.
Yeah. Yeah.
So last question about the segment on El Salvador. Do you see a democratic end to this? I mean, it's essentially an executive legislative deadlock. Do you see this becoming an ongoing problem?
Well, I think for the next year it's going to be problematic. But I will say, here's the bright side.
Good.
I think that
good. We need it.
There were a number of civilian institutions that did what you hoped they would do. The Supreme Court, you know, upholds rule of law. I mean, the Supreme Court decision on the extraordinary session, its statement on Bukele's use of the military, its warning to the military and the police, were exactly what you would have hoped to have seen, right, from the Supreme Court. The Attorney General's office, right, the same thing. I mean, you know, we saw Salvadoran institutions, both governmental and non-governmental, coming forward in a way to reaffirm rule of law in a way that you hoped would happen.
Yeah.
And so it's easy to look at this current gridlock between the president and the legislature and sort of bemoan, you know, the lack of institutionality in El Salvador. But there were a lot of other institutions that got it right. And I think that that actually is really encouraging. And, you know, whether or not deadlock is a bad thing depends on your perspective of government. You know, hey, the framers, right, of the U.S. Yeah. government designed it for gridlock for exactly
that presidential systems, they create it. That's what they are.
Yeah, right. I mean, they're designed for that. They're designed for negotiation. I mean, you know, I think one of the things that we learned was that Bukele quickly became very impatient with some of the level of questioning, which, by the way, came after one of his cabinet members took a trip on a plane with a private Mexican security firm that may or may not be, you know, benefiting from this bill. And so, you know, that popped up and then there were questions about it. And then you see that he got very defensive and this is the outcome of it.
Yeah.
He's not wrong that there's a lot of corruption
Yes,
in the
yes.
legislature, that there's a lot of corruption within the parties. He's not wrong that these are public officials who haven't always necessarily acted in the best interest of the people that they govern. But what he doesn't seem to get is that both of these things can be wrong. Corruption can be wrong, and trotting the military out for political gain can be wrong.
Right. Okay, but that so I'm we, good. We have it. We've got a silver lining here,
I got you a silver lining. That's
and
good.
that's what we'll stick with. Okay, but now so I have a separate couple questions because I was thinking about the fact that I talked to all of these scholars, all of whom have done all kinds of books and articles, and I don't think I've ever talked about the process by which they produce these things. And I noticed that you had. The newest edition of your textbook had come out, and so I thought, well, okay, I'll give you could have a plug, but then also provide just a bit of an insider view of writing and publishing. So this is the seventh edition, and how do you go
Yes.
about? And so you've got co-author. How do you go about updating the manuscript? Like, how does that process start?
Well, first, let me say that I benefit from a truly amazing co-author, John Booth, who is a ruthless editor and
Okay.
wordsmith. And without John Booth, these things are not possible. Because, as you probably know, you have something in multiple editions, they don't give you more words just because you get a new edition.
Right.
You have to make cuts to find space for new material. And John does this before we do anything else. And so John makes it possible for me to go in and to do all of my updates that I do in the country chapters, because he's so great at that. So certainly having a good co-author is really helpful. For a book like Understanding Central America, that's been around for seven editions, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
One of the things that gets more and more complicated over time is that it often is not simply a matter of revising and updating material, is that framework and other things, need to be changed over time. But the first thing that we often do, we take out reader reports. Presses are really generous about soliciting reviews from other professors who use these books in class or sometimes don't use these books in class. So we get reader reports. We sit down with the reader reports. We talk about the changes we want to make. We talk about the changes that the reviewers have suggested. And sometimes there's a lot of them, not for this book, but for the Latin American Politics and Development with Harvey Klein. We had nine reviewer reports.
Yeah.
It's a lot of information to take in. So we sit down with those and we talk about, how we think we can make the book better and how we can make it more relevant. What should we include? And sometimes what should we take out? And then we split work. John does some of the laborious work in updating all of our data and charts, which is a really exhausting job. Again, thank goodness for John Booth. And he does the data analysis from chapter. That's in our chapter nine, right? Which is La Pop data,
Okay.
which is pretty grueling and time consuming. And John does that. And I typically do the country updates in the US policy chapter and other things we do collaboratively. But, the book's been around for a while. And I learned from my students so much about issues that they care about and ways that they see the world. And every time I sit down to update a book, I think about it with them in mind. What content's missing for them? Where's the vernacular that they find accessible? Am I covering issues that they care about? And really, are we including marginalized groups in our analysis, which,
Yeah.
wasn't that common. This was my textbook, by the way, when I was an undergraduate. I used the first edition of this textbook when I was a student at Agnes Scott College. And so I know this book really intimately, even though I only joined on edition number four. I've now written, four updates of this book. And, every time I find a new way to be inclusive and to talk about different experiences of Central Americans. Are we talking about women in a way that's not just an add-on paragraph, but integrated throughout the text? Same is true of racial and ethnic minorities and LGBTQI communities as well.
So that actually gets to the other question I had was that how do you find, I mean, obviously the answer seems to be yes, but in what ways does the book evolve, even thematically and other ways, in any particular way over time?
Yeah, we did. We did one big overhaul around edition four, where we sort of restructured the book. So we haven't restructured the book since then, and it's really been more thinking about what material going forward we want to talk about. One of the fun things that you see when you go back and you read a book is like, I'm always surprised by the minute detail that I find to be important in any given edition. And I hate cutting it because my fear is that it becomes lost to memory when we give up these details, right? But sometimes it does, you worry that you do get a bit bogged down in the micro story. But trying to hit the major high points that tell the story of the history of rebellion and political change in the region. Those are the big stories that we try to make sure that we incorporate in every edition. And of course, in the US chapter, you have to talk about the changes in US administration and how that impacts the region as well.
Yeah, and especially with Trump, then that requires really a lot because oftentimes the changes between even Democratic and Republican administrations wouldn't be massive. There would be changes, but it wouldn't
Right.
be this huge.
That's pretty big. And I mean, and also, and I, there's a big vacuum. And it's tough because I'm not entirely sure that it's a good thing or a bad thing, but there's certainly a vacuum of U.S. influence in the region at the moment in terms of constraints on the type of behavior that we saw from Morales or Bukele or even Ortega, frankly.
Yes, because for the El Salvador case, it was the U.S. ambassador who was critical, and then
Yes.
that was walked back by the White House.
Yes. Yeah. And I think a lot of people noticed that.
Yeah, I would imagine. I would imagine they did.
It's, well, he's been very cooperative on security and migration issues. It's like, okay. So, yeah, I feel like he probably got affirmed through that, which is probably not the right thing to do.
And I think probably one more thing about the book is that one challenge I always found is, okay, when do I just stop writing and say, okay, more stuff is happening every single day and I have to stop.
I tell you, well, I mean, publishers have deadlines and they'll hold your feet to the fire. And my one regret of the last month was like, this would have been a better ending to the El Salvador chapter than the what kind of president will Bukele be? I mean, this would have been a much better punctuation at the end of that chapter than that. But yeah, at some point you do have to, the story breaks. And the reality is that sometimes by the time a book hits the shelf, it's dated. We
It
had this
has.
issue. Yeah, we had this issue once with a Nicaragua book, and I kept saying to the publisher, I said, just let us make it through the next election cycle. And they're like, no, it's too far out. But it was literally a matter of months. And so by the time it was on the shelf, they were well into election season. That killed me. Like, I want people when they buy a new edition of a book to feel like they're really getting an update. Like, it's really a new edition, and not just for the sake of the scant royalties that we receive, but as consumers that we've really added value to that new edition.
Yeah, well, what happened to me, I was doing the second edition of my U.S. Latin America book, and I turned in the revised manuscript about 1 week before Obama announced the Cuba thaw.
Oh, wow.
And
Yeah.
I almost had a heart attack, and I emailed them. I'm like, I have to completely rewrite the Cuba stuff. So I hope you haven't done anything,
Yeah.
and so they said fine, but I had to do it like really fast. So I had to just go in and just make sure I got every aspect of Cuba that was in there and made sure that it showed this change of policy. Because otherwise, I thought people are going to open this book and they're like, you don't even have the Cuba thaw. Like you missed the biggest change in recent history. So.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's tough. For us, the reality is once it went into production at the 1st of September, it was over. I mean, there was nothing we could really add substantively after the 1st of September, even though it's not going to be on shelves until February. That's always hard. And I think we've done well over the years in terms of, we've had to make tough calls. I remember on a previous edition of the book that was coming out, the 2009 coup in Honduras happened right as shortly after we had sent the material off to press. And John was out of the country. And I was like, oh dear, because we were going to have to talk about it. And we didn't have a lot of time to analyze the situation. It's not like we had a year to sit around and analyze the situation and debate what we wanted to call it. We had to make that decision relatively quickly. And I said, John, it's a coup. We have to call it a coup. And we went with it. You know, I mean, would it have been nice to have had another 5 or 6 months to have seen how that particular scenario was going to play out? Yeah.
Well, and but, obviously, you'd never get a book written.
No, you wouldn't, of course, right? But you know, sometimes you do you have to make really tough calls with what's going to be included or what you're going to call something. I'm happy that we got it right the first time, calling it the coup, because I think that was the right decision. In this edition of the book, we have two countries that are not democracies anymore. They are civilian autocratic governments, and that's Nicaragua and Honduras.
Yep.
And I think we get we make the right call on both of those. We looked at Honduras and we talked about Honduras for a long time, and you just, you know, at the end of the day, it's just it doesn't work for us as a democracy. And it's undeniable that Honduras is a functioning narco state. So you have to call it what it is.
Yep.
I think.
Okay, with that, we're out of time. I've been talking to Christine Wade, professor of political science and international studies at Washington College. So as we've been talking about, go check out the latest edition of her textbook, Understanding Central America, Global Forces and Political Change. Christine, thank you again.
Thanks for having me on. Next time, puppies and kittens.
Yes, I think we might have said that last time and we didn't do it, so we will. Yes, next time.